brothers and sisters, I go back to this book entitled Terrorism Trap, September 11 and Beyond by Michael Parenti, page 89. And this is why U.S. leaders intervene everywhere. President Clinton now supported the United Nations on September 27, 1993. And I quote, "Our overriding purpose is to expand and strengthen the world's community of market-based democracies." And over the past decade, U.S. policymakers have repeatedly and explicitly demanded free market reforms in one country after another in the former communist nations of Eastern Europe. Far from being wedded to each other, as U.S. leaders and opinion makers would have us believe, capitalism and democracy are often on a fatal collision course. U.S. leaders find electoral democracy useful when it helps to destabilize one-party socialism and serves as a legitimate cloak for capitalist restoration. But when it becomes a barrier to an untrampled capitalism, democracy runs into trouble. This was demonstrated when the U.S. National Security State overthrew popular democratic governments in Guatemala in 1953, Chile in 1973, Greece in 1967, Indonesia in 1965, and a score of other countries. The most recent example is Yugoslavia. Multi-ethnic Yugoslavia was once a regional industrial power and economic success, with a high annual growth rate, free medical care, a literacy rate over 90%, and a relatively equitable and prosperous economic life for its various peoples. While Yugoslavia was not, after the 1970s, a strictly socialist country, U.S. policymakers knew that the economy was still 75% publicly owned and still had a large and egalitarian public service sector that was out of line with the push toward free market third worldization. As early as 1984, the Reagan administration issued U.S. National Security Decision Directive 133, United States policy towards Yugoslavia, labeled secret sensitive. It followed closely the objectives laid out in an earlier directive aimed at Eastern Europe, one that called for a quiet revolution to overthrow communist governments while reintegrating the countries of Eastern Europe into the orbit of the world market, that is, global capitalism. The economic reforms pressed upon Yugoslavia by the IMF and other foreign creditors mandated that all socially owned firms and all worker-managed production units be transformed into private capitalist enterprises. That's what I was talking about, brothers, about the IMF strong-arming people like Al Capone used to do back during his time. In February 1999, U.S. officials at Rambouillet made their determined dedication to economic privatization perfectly clear. Chapter 4A, Article 1 of the Rambouillet Agreement, actually an ultimatum imposed upon what remained of Yugoslavia, Serbia, and Montenegro, stated in no uncertain terms, and I quote, "The economy of Kosovo shall function in accordance with free market principles." Basically, brothers, when they talk about free market, it's all about globalization, talking about exploiting the people and getting the resources for little or nothing and making huge profits. There was to be no restriction on the movement of goods, services, and capital to Kosovo, and all matters of trade, investment, and corporate ownership were to be left to the private market. In 2000, the Stability Pact for Southeastern Europe called for creating vibrant market economies in the Balkans. It was hailed by the Clinton administration for offering, and I quote, "advice on investment in all the countries of Southeast Europe." That same year, the Overseas Private Investment Corporation, OPIC, Overseas Private Investment Corporation, inaugurated a fund to be managed by Soros Private Funds Management. Its purpose, as stated by the U.S. Economy Embassy in Macedonia, is, and I quote, "to provide capital for new business development, expansion, and privatization." Meanwhile, the Agency for International Development, the USAID, announced its intention to undertake and I quote, assistance programs to support economic reforms and restructuring the economy to advance Montenegro toward a free market economy. Along with the words came the actions. A decade of IMF restructuring, years of U.S.-led boycott, embargo, wars of secession, and weeks of massive bombing in 1999 left the Yugoslav economy in ruins. In April 2001, according to the London Financial Times, the newly installed pro-West rulers of Yugoslavia, beneficiaries of millions of dollars in U.S. electoral funds, launched, and I quote here, a comprehensive privatization program as parts of economic reform introduced following the overthrow of the former president Slobodan Milosevic. This included the sale of more than 7,000 privately owned or worker-controlled companies to private investors. And brothers, that's basically what's happening here in the United States of America. Because if you notice one thing about all these companies, you can see like banks swallowing up other banks, merging, television companies merging with other television companies, and it's all about the globalization. And that, you know, of these multinational corporations, conspiracy, incompetence, and inertia. All of us are expected to make plans and intentionally pursue certain goals in life. And we recognize that throughout history, other nations have defined objectives that they have carried through with resolve. But when one suggests that the U.S. national security state operates with foreordained intent, mainstream social scientists and media pundits dismiss such a notion as conspiracy theory. Policies that produce unfortunate effects on others are explained away as unintended consequences. And brothers, this is what we can look, you know, with the unintended consequence, we look at public policy over here with the so-called war on drugs. And we can see who has benefited from the war on drugs and who is losing at the other end of the spectrum of the so-called war on drugs, namely black folks. Of course, unintended consequences do arise, and upheavals do sometimes catch U.S. leaders off guard. But there is no reason to reduce so much a policy outcome to statualism, to argue that things almost always occur by chance. Stuff just happens, as innocently befuddled leaders grope about unburdened by any preconceived agenda. Brothers, that's why I was saying that at the beginning of this tape, that a lot of things that we are hearing about on the news about them going to invade or bomb Iraq and the things that happened with Afghanistan and the so-called, you know, terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon were all pre-planned. Everything that goes on this planet, such as the wars, the overthrowing of governments, even with the so-called war on drugs, it has all been pre-planned. Nothing happens by accident. To say as I do, the U.S. national security leaders know more, intend more, and do more than they let on is not to claim they are omnipotent or omnicompetent. It is to argue that U.S. policy is not habitually misguided and bungling, although mistakes are made and indiscrepancies certainly arise. General U.S. Foreign policy is remarkably consistent and cohesive, a deadly success given the interests it represents. Sometimes the policymakers themselves seize upon incompetence as a cover. In 1986, it was discovered that the Reagan administration was running a covert operation to bypass Congress and the law, using funds from secret arms sales to Iran to finance counter-revolutionary mercenaries, the Contras, in Nicaragua, and probably GOP electoral campaigns at home. Come with the Iran-Contra affair, brothers and sisters. President Reagan admitted full knowledge of the arms sale, but claimed he had no idea what happened to the money. He was asking us to believe that these operations were being conducted by subordinates, including his very own national security advisor, without being cleared by him. Reagan publicly criticized himself for his slipshod managerial style and lack of administrative control over his staff. His admission of incompetence was eagerly embraced by various commentators who prefer to see their leaders as suffering from innocent ignorance rather than to see deliberate deception. Subsequent sworn testimony by his subordinates, however, revealed that Reagan was not as dumb as he was pretending to be, and that he had played a deciding role in the entire Iran-Contra affair. And brothers and sisters, that's when they was always talking about he had Alzheimer's disease. I'm sure he has it now, but back during that time, he showed, you know, a lot of us that knew what was going on knew he didn't have no Alzheimer's. He had to be involved because he was at the highest levels of this government, namely the President of the United States of America. Throughout its history, the CIA and other agencies of the national security state have resorted to every conceivable crime and machination, using false propaganda, sabotage, bribery, rigged elections, collusion with organized crime, narcotics trafficking, death squads, terror bombings, torture, massacres, and wars of attrition. At the same time, U.S. leaders have pretended to have had nothing to do with such things. No less a political percentage than Henry Kissinger repeatedly pretended to ignorance, incompetence when confronted with the dirty role he and his cohorts played in East Timor, Indochina, Chile, Bangladesh, and everywhere, and also in Africa too, brothers and sisters. We can't forget Africa. Kissinger's writings and speeches are heavily larded with exhortations about the importance of maintaining the efficiency of U.S. policy and the need to impress the world with the mettle of U.S. resolve. Yet in response to any inquiry that might implicate him in political crimes, he rushes to humiliate his own country and its professional servants, suggesting that they know little, care less, are poorly informed, and easily rattled by the pace of events. One of the magazines I go to for a lot of information, brothers and sisters, is Covert Action Quarterly. And in the same issue, number 70 for April-June 2001, where it talked about the Star Wars program, they talk about Kissinger. Page 23 to 25, Kissinger's crime. Nora King on Dr. Henry Kissinger's brutal history in the U.S. and abroad. Now, I can't really get into detail about this, but if you pick up the magazine or you go on the internet, you can probably get the article. But some of you out there who are conscious and know about Henry Kissinger, the Big New Brzezinski, National Security Study Memorandum 200, Global 2000, you all pretty much know about this man's track record when it's dealing with people of color and the poor on this planet. We go to page 95. Sometimes outcomes are explained away as the result of a disembodied organizational inertia. Interventions are said to occur because a national security agency wants to prove its usefulness or is simply carried along on its own organizational momentum, as supposedly happened with the CIA and the Pentagon intervention in Cuba during the Bay of Pigs invasion in 1961. To be sure, organizational modes of operation do come into play, but to see them as the predominant force behind policies is like claiming that the horses are the cause of the horse race. The other variable argument. U.S. leaders may be motivated by all sorts of concerns, such as advancing the nation's prestige, maintaining national security against potentially competing capitalist nations, developing strategic military superiority, distracting the American public from domestic problems and scandals. And that's what's going on right now, brothers and sisters, with this whole thing with the United States wanting to invade Iraq. That's one of the reasons. Advancing the heroic macho image of the president and the like. But these purposes almost always dovetail when the dominant capitalist interests or certainly do not challenge those interests in any serious way. Thus, while a U.S. president might be interested in promoting his macho image, he would never think of doing so by supporting the cause of socialist reformation in this or any other country. The office holders seek to achieve many other purposes. Ralph Miliband once noted, and I quote, should not obscure the fact that in the service of those purposes, they become the dedicated servants of their business and invest in classes. The point is not that nations act imperialistically for purely material motives, but that in addition to other considerations, policymakers will not move against the system sustaining material interest of the dominant corporate class. In sum, when trying to understand the events of September 11, we need to remember that U.S. political corporate elites have resorted to every conceivable subterfuge, coercion, and act of terrorist violence in their struggle to make the world safe for transnational corporate capital accumulation. To attain control of the markets, lands, natural resources, and cheap labor of all countries, and to prevent the emergence of revolutionary socialist, populist, or even nationalist regimes that challenge this argument by seeking to build alternative productive systems. The goal is to create a world populated by client states and complaint populations open to transnational corporate penetration on terms that are completely favorable to the penetrators. It is not too much to conclude that such a consistent and ruthless policy of global hegemony is produced not by dumb coincidence, but by conscious design. And that's what I was, and that's what I was telling you about before, brothers and sisters. Nothing happens by accident. Things are planned, and things happen. But like I stated before, not by accident, but by design. Now, brothers and sisters, I'm going to one of my favorite publications here, "And the Truth Shall Set You Free: The Most Explosive Book of the 20th Century" by David Icke. And this is page 259, a chapter entitled "The Debt Scam." The so-called third world debt, which is crucifying great swaths of our fellow humanity across Africa, Asia, and Latin America, causing unspeakable misery, is debt on money that will never exist. And the banks sent out representatives in droves across the third world, talking about the bankers, lending money like confetti and looking especially for corrupt and incompetent politicians who they knew would waste it. Why would they do that? Because it was the land and natural resources of these countries the elite are after, and still are. They want them to default on their debts. That's the ideal. The plan was to offer them forgiveness of debt in return for rights over those countries' natural resources for all time. This is happening today, and those leaders who refuse are being removed in people's revolutions and assassinations. And by the way, that's in quotations. The non-existent money was lent to third world at flexible interest rates. If world interest rates went up, the repayments increased. So lend them the money when interest rates are relatively low and then hit them with the sting. And pretty much, brothers and sisters, the same thing that's happening now with people losing their homes here in the United States of America, or losing their cars, or, you know, with credit cards, things of that nature. And we go to another chapter here, and same, called "The Debt Scam." Chapter 11, "Stealing the Planet." Today we continue to see the next stage in the elite third world debt strategy, to forgive or restructure the debt in return for land and resources, for natural resources. The environmental movement is playing a part, most unknowingly, in this. One of the initiatives supported by many of the environmental movements is known as debt for equality. Under this proposal, the international debt of third world countries is forgiven in return for handing over areas of wilderness and environmentally sensitive lands. It is promoted as a system that wins both ways. The debts of poor countries are reduced, and these wilderness and other lands are protected. Unfortunately, the green movement in general has a very poor record of looking behind the smokescreen thrown up by the New World Order crowd. Firstly, the scheme would not reduce debt. It would change the nature of it and steal the land of these countries. And secondly, who is behind the ideal? Ladies and gentlemen, let's hear it for David Rockefeller and Baron Edmund de Rothschilds. One example of this is something called the World Conservation Bank, the WCB, which was apparently initiated at the Fourth World Wilderness Conference held on September 13, 1987 at Denver, Colorado, and continued over the following 4 days at the notorious Aspen Institute for Humanistic Studies. Basically, brothers and sisters, that's what this whole thing is about. with these the elite or these bankers or whoever you want to name getting land by putting, you know, by putting up banners, or not banners, but saying that, well, we have an endangered species, so you can't get the land. Or there's a tree or a shrub that's endangered, so you can't get the land. And then, too, like I stated before, from reading that article there, or that part of that chapter there, with the banks coming in, lending all this money to these corrupt dictators. And the corrupt dictators blow the money or spend the money on their own selfish needs, and the people still suffering. And then what ends up happening, the bankers come in, you know, foreclose on the loan and take the land. And it's crazy. And speaking of which, brothers and sisters, which brings me to a National Security Council Memorandum -46. National Security Council Memorandum -46. And this is dated March 17, 1978. Presidential Review Memorandum to Secretary of State, the Secretary of Defense, the Director of the CIA. Subject: Black America and the U.S. Black Movement. This is the reason why, brothers and sisters, that I say that black folks here in this country need to start studying more about public policy and U.S. foreign policy. And I'm going to read this whole article. It's only 6 pages long. The president has directed that a comprehensive review be made of current developments in black America from the point of view of their possible impacts on the black movement in the United States. The review should consider: 1. Long-term tendencies of social and political developments and the degree to which they are consistent with or contradict the U.S. interests. 2. Proposals for durable contacts between radical African leaders and leftist leaders of the U.S. black community. 3. Appropriate steps to be taken inside and outside the country in order to inhibit any pressure by radical African leaders and organizations on the U.S. black community for the latter to exert influence on the policies of the administration toward Africa. The president has directed that the National Security Council Interdepartmental Group for Africa perform this review. The review should be forwarded to the NSC Political Analysis Committee by April 20th. Signed, Zbigniew Brzezinski. And by the way, he is the founder, if I'm not mistaken, of the Trilateral Commission. And we really going to get into this now. National Security Council Interdepartmental Group for Africa Study Response to Presidential Security Review Memorandum NSC-46. Objective of our policy toward black Africa is to prevent social upheavals which could radically change the political situation throughout the area. The success or failure of our policy in the region depends on the situation, international and internal issues, whose importance of the United States is on the increase. 2. A U.S. interest in black Africa. A multiplicity of interests influences the U.S. attitude towards black Africa. The most important of these interests can be summarized as follows. 1. Political. If black African states assume attitudes hostile to the U.S. national interest, our policy towards the white regimes, which is a key element of our relations with the black states, may be subjected by the latter to great pressure for fundamental change. Thus the West may face a real danger of being deprived of access to the enormous raw material resources of Southern Africa, which are vital for our defense needs, as well as losing control over the Cape Sea routes by which approximately 65% of the Middle East oil is supplied to Western Europe. Moreover, such a development may bring about internal political difficulties by intensifying the activity of the black movement in the United States itself. It should also be borne in mind that the black Africa is an integral part of a continent where tribal and regional discord, economic backwardness, inadequate infrastructures, drought, and famine are constant features of the scene. In conjunction with the artificial borders imposed by the former colonial powers, guerrilla warfare in Rhodesia and widespread indignation against apartheid in South Africa, the above factors provide the communist states with ample opportunities for furthering their aims. This must necessarily redound to the detriment of U.S. political interests. Economic. That's number 2. Black Africa is increasingly becoming an outlet for U.S. exports and investment. The mineral resources of the area continue to be of great value for the normal functioning of industry in the United States and allied countries. And I'm sure they're talking about white countries. In 1977, U.S. direct investment in Black Africa totaled about $1.8 billion, and exports $2.2 billion. New prospect of substantial profits will continue to develop in the countries concerned. Roman numeral 4, Black Africa and the U.S. Black Movement. Apart from the above-mentioned factors adverse to U.S. strategic interests, the Nationalist Liberation Movement in Black Africa can act as a catalyst with far-reaching effects on the black on the American black community by stimulating its organizational consideration and by inducing radical actions. Such a result would be likely as Zaire went the way of Angola and Mozambique. An occurrence of the events of 1967 and 68 would do grievous harm to U.S. prestige, especially in view of the concerns of the present administration with human rights issues. Moreover, the administration would have to take specific steps to stabilize the situation. Such steps might be misunderstood both inside and outside the United States. In order to prevent such a trend and protect U.S. national security interests, it would appear essential to elaborate and carry out effective countermeasures. 1. Possibility of joint action by U.S. black and African nationalist movement. In elaborating U.S. policy toward black Africa, due weight must be given to the fact that there are 25 million American blacks whose roots are African, who consciously or subconsciously sympathize with African nationalism. The living conditions of the black population should also be taken into account. Immense advances in the field are accompanied by a long-lasting high rate of unemployment, especially among the youth, and by poverty and dissatisfaction with government and social welfare standards. These factors taken together may provide a basis for joint actions of a concrete nature by the African nationalist movement and the U.S. black community. Basically, actions would take the form of demonstrations and public protests, but the likelihood of violence cannot be excluded. There would also be attempts to coordinate their political activity both locally and in international organizations. Inside the United States, these actions could include protest demonstrations against our policies towards South Africa. Now remember, this is 1978, accompanied by a demand for boycotting corporations and banks which maintain links with that country, attempts to establish a permanent black lobby in Congress, including activist leftist radical groups and black legislators, the reemergence of the Pan-African ideals, resumption a protest marches recalling the days of Dr. Martin Luther King, renewal of the extremist ideal, national ideal of establishing an African republic on American soil. Finally, leftist radical elements of the black community could resume extremist action in the style of the now defunct Black Panther Party. And bro, what this basically is saying here is they don't want black Americans and brothers and sisters from the motherland to come together. That's the reason why you see so much disinformation about Africa through the magazines, through the newspapers, and through the music, of why they don't want black folks to come together as a whole here in the United States or in Africa. Internationally, damage could be done to the United States by coordinated activity of African states designed to condemn U.S. policy towards South Africa and initiate discussions on the U.S. racial issue at the United Nations, where the African representation constitutes a powerful bloc with about one-third of all votes. A menace to U.S. economic interests, though not a critical one, could be posed by a boycott by black African states against American companies which maintain contact with South Africa and Rhodesia. If the ideal of economic assistance to black Americans shared by some African regimes could be realized by their placing orders in the United States mainly with companies owned by blacks, they could gain a limited influence on the U.S. black community. Like I stated before, brothers, they don't want us to come together. In the above context, we must envisage the possibility, however remote, that black Americans' interest in African affairs may refocus their attention on the Arab-Israeli conflict. Taking into account the African descent of the American blacks, it is reasonable to anticipate that their sympathies would lie with the Arabs, who are closer to them in spirit and in some cases related to them by blood. Black involvement and lobbying to support the Arabs may lead to serious dissension between American black and Jews. The likelihood of extremist actions by either side is negotiable, but the discord may bring about tension in the internal political climate of the United States. Political options. That's number three. In the context of the long-term strategy, the United States cannot afford a radical change in the fundamentals of its African policy, which is designed for maximum protection of national security. It is, in the present case, emphasis is laid on the importance of black Africa for U.S. political, economic, and military interests. Recommendations. Now, brothers, this is going to get deep here. In weighing the range of U.S. interest in black Africa, basic recommendations arranged without intent to imply priority are: 1. Specific steps should be taken with the help of appropriate government agencies to inhibit coordinated activity of the black movement in the United States. They're talking about the counterintelligence program, brothers and sisters. Special clandestine operations should be launched by the CIA to generate mistrust and hostility in America and world opinion against joint activity of the two forces and to cause division among black African radical national groups and their leaders. I'm talking about basically using propaganda and distrust. 3. U.S. embassies to black African countries specifically interested in Southern Africa must be highly circumspected in view of the activity of certain political circles and influence individuals opposing the objectives and methods of U.S. policy towards South Africa. It must be kept in mind that the failure of U.S. strategy in South Africa would adversely affect American standing throughout the world. In addition, this would mean a significant diminution of U.S. influence in Africa and the emergence of new difficulties in our internal situation due to worsening economic prospects. Number 4, the FBI should mount surveillance operations against black African representatives and collect sensitive information on those, especially at the UN, who oppose U.S. policy towards South Africa. The information should include facts on their links with the leaders of the black movement in the United States, thus making possible at least partial neutralization of the adverse effects of their activity. Basically, once again, brothers and sisters, the counterintelligence program, COINTELPRO. Trends in the black movement. This is on Roman numeral 5. In connection with our African policy, it is highly important to evaluate correctly the present state of the black movement in the United States and basing ourselves on all available information to try to devise a course for its future development. Such an approach is strongly suggested by our perception of the fact that American blacks form a single ethnic group potentially capable of causing extreme instability in our strategy towards South Africa. This may lead to critical differences between the United States and black Africa in particular. It would also encourage the Soviet Union to set up its interference in the region. Finally, it would pose a serious threat to the delicate structure of race relations within the United States. All the above considerations give rise to concern for the future security of the United States. And brothers, what they're saying is they're faking the funk because, you know, there's still a lot of racial tension and hostilities in this country perpetrated by other people, particularly Caucasian people. Since the mid-1960s, when legislation on human rights was passed and Martin Luther King murdered, federal and local measures to improve black welfare have been taken, as a result of which the U.S. black movement has undergone considerable changes. Social and economic issues have supplanted political aims as the main preoccupations of the movement, and actions formerly planned on a nationwide scale are now being organized locally fragmentation and lack of organizational unity within the movement, sharp social stratification of the black population, and lack of policy options which could reunite them, which means black folks coming together under one banner regardless of religion, race, regardless of skin color, regardless of religion or creed or political parties. That's what they mean there, brothers and sisters. One, of a national leader of standing comparable to Martin Luther King. B, the range of policy options. The concern for the future security of the United States makes necessary the range of policy options. Arranged without the intent, implied priority they are. A, to enlarge programs within the framework of the public budget, or the present budget, for the improvement of the social and economic welfare of American blacks in order to ensure continuing development of present trends in the black movement. B, to elaborate and bring into effect a special program designed to perpetuate division in the black movement and neutralize the most active groups of leftist radicals, organizations representing different social strata of the black community to encourage division in black circles. Basically, counterintelligence program once again, brothers and sisters, to preserve the present climate which inhibits the emergence from within the black leadership of a person capable of exerting nationwide appeal. And brothers and sisters, I gotta stop right there. One person did do that. His name was Marcus Messiah Garvey. He brought 8 million black folks together from all around the planet under the banner of the UNIA, the Universal Negro Improvement Association. And also Malcolm X might have been the man also, but he was assassinated when he started going international. D, to work out and realize preventive operations in order to impede durable ties between U.S. black organizations and radical groups in the African states. E, to support actions designed to sharpen social stratification in the black community, which would lend to the widening and perception of the gap between successful educated blacks and the poor, giving rise to growing antagonism between black groups and a weakening of the movement as a whole. And basic services, what they're saying there is, you got a lot of black folks who got a lot of education, and they think that they better than poor black folks. Even though some of these same black folks, like Condoleezza Rice or Colin Powell, came from the same, they started off the same, with nothing. To facilitate the greatest possible expansion of black business by granting government contracts and loans with favorable terms to black businessmen. Basically, as long as they don't talk about reunification of black Africa and black America, then basically selling out the community. But I don't find nothing wrong with black business as long as black folks support those businesses. G, to take every possible means through the AFL-CIO leaders to counteract the increasing influence of black labor organizations, which function in all major unions, and in particular, the National Coalition of Black Trade Union and its leadership, including the creation of real preference for adverse and hostile reaction among white trade unionists to demands for improvement of social and economic welfare of the blacks. H, to support the nomination at federal and local levels of loyal black public figures to elective offices, to government agencies, and the court. Basically, brothers and sisters, support those black folks who go along with the status quo, who don't want to have nothing, as long as they ain't saying nothing about unifying the black masses or, going against the public policies or the U.S. foreign policies against Africa, then they gonna pump more money into them. This will promote the achievement of a twofold purpose. First, it will be easier to control the activity of loyal black representatives within existing institutions. Second, the ideal of an independent black political party now under discussion within the black leadership circles will soon lose all support. Basically, brothers, like I said before, to buy out the black leadership. The ones that have sold out. And we can look at examples of that across this country. Right now, brothers and sisters, I must be going, and I hope you truly enjoyed this tape. The information that I used tonight came from the book entitled The Terrorism Trap, September 11th and Beyond by Michael Parenthi, and the chapter was entitled Why U.S. Leaders Intervene Everywhere. Also used part of Covert Action Quarterly, and I went to an article entitled Space Corps, The Dangerous Business of Making the Heavens a War Zone, page 26 by Carl Grossman. I used part of a book entitled And the Truth Shall Set You Free by David Icke, the most explosive book of the 20th century, The Debt Scam, and we went to Third World Debt. Right now, brothers, I'm going to leave you with this right here. Oh, before I forget, the other document that I used was entitled National Security Council Memorandum-46, Black Africa and the U.S. Movement. And this was dated March 1st, 1978. The reason why I used this was to show you the correlation of why black folks in this country need to study public policy and U.S. foreign policy and how it affects us as a whole. And you can get this off www.directblackaction.com. Memo 46. Right now, brothers, I'm going to leave you with two. I'm going to leave you something from Noam Chomsky. Noam Chomsky, The Prosperous Few and the Restless Many. And this is from the back of this publication. We now have an international economy, and we're moving toward an international state, creating, to quote the business press, a new imperial age with a de facto world government. NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, is a secret document whose decisions will override those of Congress, states, localities. It's a real success in the long-term project of depriving democratic structures of any substance. Biotechnology, genetic engineering, designing animal species, etc., is potentially vastly more important than electronics. In fact, compared to the potential of biotechnology, electronics is sort of a frill. And this is what he said about Somalia. I don't think Somalia should be classified as an intervention. It is more of a public relations operation. For the Pentagon, they desperately need some way to prevent the Pentagon budget from declining. And that's from his book entitled The Prosperous Few and the Restless Many. And brothers and sisters, I hope you truly enjoyed this tape and took notes to understand the reason why other countries or other people in other countries do not like the United States. Now, don't get me wrong. A lot of you may be saying, well, this nigga anti-American, or, you know, he don't believe in America, or he needs to be booted out. The problem is, a lot of us don't want to face the truth and understand that globalization is evil, the New World Order is evil, and the agenda that they have is that, like I stated before, that the New World Order's globalization affects, you know, not just the folks in those other countries, but it affects us also. Like I stated before, from the stuff that, you know, from the article, from the items that I read, it not only exploits the people over in those countries, but it also takes the land and mainly the natural resources. But also in this country, people are losing jobs because of globalization. And it's smart business sense if you really think about it. Because basically what it's saying is that we can get more goods, you know, we can get more goods because we're paying the people less. Good example is when they move a lot of the jobs down to Mexico. Here it is up here that's paying people $15 an hour. When you could pay the people down there $5 a day, you can get three people for the price of one. And that's something to think about, brothers and sisters. And like I said before, till then, peace and hair grease and have a good night.
Never stop, never give up. Never stop, never give up.